time to another exciting episode of the Table Topics Podcast. My name is Caleb, and joining me today are...
Addis.
Christian.
Santiago.
And today, we got another exciting episode. I know I say it every time, but this one's true. I would say this one is probably my favorite. It's Eclipse Phase. Eclipse Phase First Edition, instead of the Second Edition. Next episode, we'll be talking about the Second Edition, but this one's all about Version 1, baby.
1.0.
Yeah, I love Eclipse Phase.
We all love Eclipse Phase here, maybe some more than others. It was my first
non-D&D
tabletop, so it's got a special place in my heart. So I guess we'll start right off the bat. What is Eclipse Phase?
Eclipse Phase is technically like a post-apocalyptic sci-fi space RPG, but when you're actually playing it, sometimes it doesn't really feel like it's post-apocalyptic, because essentially the Earth is ruined, and humanity lives in everywhere else in the solar system, on the moon, on Mars, in the Jupiter's moons, in the belts, and beyond, in habitats and otherwise.
Yeah, it's pretty far removed from the initial apocalypse,
yes.
So it's very... very far post-apocalypse, where there have been insane technology advances even since that time.
Yeah,
but
it's set in like the far future. It's like a thousand years from now type future.
Exactly. And so there are a lot of like, it does feel like a high sci-fi fantasy sort of.
Yes, absolutely. But if you look at certain elements of it, it does very much, like, you start seeing the elements that make it technically a post-apocalypse.
Yeah.
Because an apocalypse did happen.
Yeah, it's kind of cool because, I mean, we'll get into this in the lore a little bit more, but you see the kind of current state of things of like, oh yeah, there's a large overarching sort of diplomatic relationships between a bunch of different factions, you know, in kind of a more, you know, modern day setting and like not very post-apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also still see the remnants from the apocalypse kind of like rear its head in some areas, right?
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like a gentle reminder here and there, but there's also that constant threat of, you know, that
it
apocalypse, you know, the results of it, you know, really rearing its head.
And I feel like that lends itself to the core setting, the core way you're playing the game. The main way that the writers of the story want you to play is you're playing as part of Firewall, and Firewall is this organization that has formed post this apocalypse and, you know, this far in the future to make sure that nothing happens to threaten the continued existence of humanity again.
Mm-hmm.
That humanity can continue to exist, and, you know, that's like their main goal, and you're playing as agents of Firewall.
Yeah.
Is humanity the right term?
It's
in Eclipse Phase.
Yeah.
In Eclipse Phase, the term they use is transhumanity, because another part of that is in the technological evolution that comes to humanity before the apocalypse, a lot of other like beings emerge with human level sentience and intelligence and all that.
Some naturally, some not naturally.
Naturally, some not naturally, yes.
You have what are known as uplifts in the setting that are uplifted sapient animals. So those are normally, there are Corvian uplifts, which are like crow uplifts. Mm-hmm. There are octopus uplifts.
Primate
uplifts are the most prominent, because there's like apes and of all kinds, and you also have AI that have been uplifted to human levels of intelligence and cognitive processing.
You skipped over my favorite uplift, which is the marine mammals.
Oh yeah, there's
dolphins
also dolphins
and whales. But yeah, so these have all mostly through technological help have achieved human-level intelligence. And so, as a whole, this whole collective of humans, all these uplifts, the AIs, like the intelligent AIs and all that, are referred to as transhumanity.
Mm-hmm.
I feel another part that helps this, and this is like a core mechanic in the game, but it's also core to the lore, is that they have discovered ways to get past aging and get past the body mortality problem.
So you're talking about the ego versus morph sort of thing.
Yes.
So separating your mind from your body.
Exactly. And that's a very core tenet of Eclipse Phase. And it helps you get into the frame of mind of Eclipse Phase if you understand its two primary influences. One of them is Altered Carbon, a different sci-fi series, book series, and television series as well. And The Expanse, which is, again, another television series, another book series. And those two influences are at the core of what makes Eclipse Phase Eclipse Phase.
Yeah, it's nice that those have been kind of become very popular recently as well. I remember it was funny, I had watched Altered Carbon, the series, and then they started talking about, like,
the
cortical stacks, and I was like, wait a second, that's from
Eclipse Phase,
and I went and checked a book, and I was like, in the sort of acknowledgements, it says, oh, yeah, we were inspired by these works, and one of them was Altered Carbon, the, like, book series, and I was like, oh, okay, so it wasn't, like, the other way around, so that was kind of funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the idea of being able to digitize your consciousness, your mind.
Which in the book they call the ego.
Ego. And then your body, or, you know, sometimes it's mechanical, or, you know,
biological,
more of a biological.
Or a mix.
Or a mix, exactly. And that's referred to as the morph.
Yeah.
And so if your body dies, then you can just be put into a new body.
Yeah, the cortical stack could be retrieved, or you could have a backup of your ego somewhere, and that could just be downloaded onto a body. Mm-hmm. You could have two versions of yourself in two different bodies that exist at the same time.
And that actually has a term in the game and in the setting. It's called fork.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you fork yourself.
Yeah.
You have two versions of yourself.
Yeah, so then you can also fork yourself.
You can go fork yourself.
Yeah.
Not to get too deep in the weeds of the setting lore of it, but there's a whole, like, setting appropriate way of handling copies of your ego.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually illegal to have a full copy of your ego if you're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so copies of you are designated by Greek letters. So the perfect copy, unaltered version of you is called, like, an alpha fork. Whereas, like, the most dumbed down, like, basic copy of you is, like, I think it's, like, an omega fork or something like that.
Yeah.
And there's everything in between. And it's actually illegal to have more than one copy of you out in the...
As long as it's in a backup somewhere, it's okay to have your alpha somewhere. But...
Yeah.
Yeah, if it's out in the world. And sometimes, like, that's another area for, you know, storytelling, complications and stuff. And
so
also
murder your player. player characters.
Yes, that's
the
thing.
In a way, it's, like, almost encouraged to murder the player, and they can download their ego onto a new body.
And there's also mechanics for going into a new morph from your ego.
Yeah, because it's a traumatizing event.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's mechanics for that. There's also, like, that's why injuries are handled in two different ways. There's, like, physical injuries, and there's also psychological injuries.
Yeah.
And depending on when you back up your ego, it's like, if you back it up before you take the psychological injuries, then you don't have memories of everything that happened after.
Mm-hmm.
But if you back it up afterwards, then you keep those psychological injuries even if you're in a new body.
And psychological injuries are the only... not the only, but the primary way of having a true death in the system.
Yeah. And then you need something like psychosurgery to maybe help with that.
Which is also another setting thing.
Yeah.
Psychological surgery that actually takes its cues from Altered Carbon as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, a lot of this, if you've watched or read Altered Carbon, a lot of the stuff is pretty one-to-one. Like, even just going into a new morph, it's like the same sort of, like, yeah, it's like a very traumatizing event. It really takes you out of it. When you first get into a new body, you're not going to be... Like, there are some traits that you can take. This is, like, player character creation stuff.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it is, like, a really, you know, destabilizing experience.
There's a whole thing about alienation, and you have negative modifiers while you're going through that period and, like, getting used to your new body.
Yeah.
Like,
a sort of
together.
Body dysmorphia sort of situation.
Yeah.
Because even if you get the same, like... Again, this, you know... In this future, genetic manipulation is a thing, and, like, synthetic bodies are a thing. So even if you get into the same exact model, all with all the same settings of the same mechanical synthetic morph, there's still going to be some alienation. Mm-hmm. And the more foreign the body swap is, like going from like a you know, two legs, two arms, synth morph.
Into an octopus?
To a biological octopus? Yes. A lot
or
of differences.
Like a base human, I think they're called flats,
yeah.
to something like a mechanical octopus.
Yeah.
Wait, actually, and that's why those kind of morphs in the setting are made. Like, if you're an uplift and you're used to having eight arms, it's very uncomfortable for you to suddenly be put into, like, a 6-foot-tall human...
Bipedal yeah.
man
yeah.
named Joe, and you're like, where are my other arms?
You got phantom limbs.
Yeah, exactly.
But then there's also the stuff of, like, yeah, there's the use to it. And then there's also people just going far off. There are very, very cool things. Like, swarm bodies is a thing,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, you know, your body is not a single body. It's just, like, all these small bots that swarm together into, like,
mm-hmm.
a type of body. Infomorphs are a thing. Like, your body, you could not have
not
a physical...
Yeah,
not have a physical body. Your body is purely digital, and you only exist through what they call the mesh, which is kind of like a network.
Sort of.
Like an internet 4.0 at that
Yeah,
point.
It's like a peer-to-peer sort of internet.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
a peer-to-peer internet, and, like, in big societies, it works like an internet,
mm-hmm.
but in, like, small, closed-off places, it's, like, just your
local
network.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
But it's, like, all of it is the same, using the same technology, so they
yeah.
just generalize it to call it the mesh.
Yeah.
And we're talking about all this, like, things that players have access to, that the setting and the people that live in it have access to, and it sounds very high-minded, high sci-fi, a utopia even. In some places, like, there's, like, no currency, there's no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They rely on a very, like, almost Star Trek-esque social
yeah.
system.
Yeah.
And we talk about this, but one thing that makes Eclipse Phase very unique in this way is that there's always that air of dread and psychological horror permeating throughout
mm-hmm.
it. And that's actually kind of why I think they called it Eclipse Phase. An eclipse phase, in our real world terms, is the period between a cell's infection and the production of viruses from that cell. And that kind of ties into what the setting is, because the apocalypse happened, the infection happened, and now it's kind of like a permeating dread of, like, every once in a while you see, oh, things aren't actually getting better.
Yeah.
Things are actually still very, very
bad. It's almost
bad.
Like the eye of the storm. Like,
exactly.
you've been hit by something, and now there's a bit of calm, but you know that there's something still out there just waiting to be set off.
All of the big stories and campaigns that are written for Eclipse Phase by the creators all touch on this kind of, like, lingering dread of what's happened, and therefore what could or will happen in the
mm-hmm.
future.
Okay. So one thing I want to mention, if that's all right,
yeah.
is Psy and hacking.
Yeah.
Because I think those are kind of the two more specialized pseudo-classes.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, because this game, like some other games we've talked about, doesn't have a class system. It
mm-hmm.
has a skill system, and then you can pick whatever skills you want, kind of like
yeah.
Shadowrun. We talked about this before.
Yeah.
For most things, you don't have all the trappings of a class. You can get whatever you
yeah.
want. Psy and hacking are, like, some very clear, like, deviations from the norm
mm-hmm.
That require you to know rules that you wouldn't have to know otherwise. Let's be real. That's what it boils down
yeah.
to.
Yeah, I think, like, the other ones, like, you can make, like, a fighter character that's good at, you know, blades or guns or... whatever, but and also be a face. Like
yeah.
I think there's a lot more like mix and match, and you can mix and match with Psy and hacking, but they're very like focused things that you usually
yeah.
invest
in. There's a lot more mechanics for those two things than
yeah.
basically
yes.
everything else.
I actually do feel like more than any other system,
mm-hmm.
you can mix Psy and hacking with other things.
Oh,
in our
yeah.
one shot,
you definitely can.
Santi played a Psy character that was just a combat character
mm-hmm.
with, like, you know, basically Psy being all its like bumped up abilities
yeah.
through Psy rather than through augments or what have
yeah.
you. So I think that
cool.
totally works. The thing with it is they have unique rules. And
yeah.
so it's like if you're doing any Psy or any hacking, you have to read these rules. But if
yeah.
you don't, you're not planning to, then you do not have to read these rules. That's what makes it, I feel like, gives it that distinction.
Yeah, and I think specifically for Psy, you have to, your character can either be able to do Psy abilities, which...
Or they're not.
Or they're not. And Psy is kind of like magic in other systems, similar to...
Psionics.
Yeah, is the, what it's kind of...
Fancy
shortened.
Brain powers.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like mental magic sort of thing, is... A way you can think of it as an analogy to other systems.
It still boils down to being, like, setting-wise and lore-wise, to being scientific. This, like, setting it doesn't have a lot of, like, just magic.
There's no pure magic.
Yeah, it's
no
so magic. It's all some kind of science. So psionics are meant to be some kind of mixture of brain waves and chemicals that you use to affect other biological brains around you, which is why psionics cannot affect cyber brains, for example. So you can't affect synthmorphs. In the same, unless they have a synthmorph with a biological brain, which you can have. In the same way, hacking, you can hack cyber brains, but you can't hack a biological brain.
Well, that actually is very interesting. You say you can't hack a biological brain. Because
it depends.
One of the core, like, themes and properties of Eclipse Phase is what is known as the Exosurgeon virus, which is what caused the apocalypse. And there's multiple variants, and it's a very important part of the setting. And not to get into the weeds of it, but that virus is kind of like the launch pad of every weird thing that happens in the setting, from hacking biological brains to creating monsters to even the psionics that the players have access to is technically caused by a variant strain of that virus.
Yeah, but it still has that, like, grounded in sci-fi. It's like, it's not magic. This is just an ability we don't know based on this virus.
But to Santi's point, it's like all of the more fantastical elements of the setting are related to this virus. So it's like, here's our scientific explanation for all of the kooky magic and fantasy stuff that we want to include in the setting.
Let's have these threads connected.
Let's talk about the dice and the actual mechanics of the system. So the thing that I like, and I think a lot of us like about Eclipse Phase in its uniqueness, is that it's a D100 system, which we haven't seen on the podcast before at this point, or we haven't reviewed it, where you roll 2D10s, and your target number you have to roll under it. So if your target number normally it's based on a skill... So if you have 60 points in a skill and you don't have any modifiers on that roll, you roll 2d10 and you have to roll under or meeting 60.
And that's, you would succeed on that, and above you would fail.
I like that a lot, because, like, what you're rolling, if you're rolling against a skill most of the time, so skills do have, like, the classic RPG of it's an attribute plus your skill rating, and those go from 0 to 99. And you can fine-tune skills a lot, but fundamentally you're always rolling the same thing. You're always rolling a D100 and comparing that to your skill. Any modifiers don't modify the dice, they just modify that your skill value that you're trying to get under.
Yeah, just your target. So you can get away with having even just one D10 if you want, and then just rolling that twice for these checks.
Yeah.
But I would recommend just 2D10 for, you know, either
one
each
for
player
ones,
or
ones for tens.
Yeah, exactly. And there are specific dice out there, one that counts the tens, one that counts the ones, you know.
Yeah. But yeah, it's very simple dice wise, because the skill system, again, personally reminds me of Shadowrun. Shadowrun also has modifiers the same way this has it, but this is just a so much more elegant way to do the same kind of mechanical complexity, I think.
I think it takes a bit of, like, getting used to wanting to roll under a number.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you want lower numbers, kind of.
Like,
see, like,
the double zeros is the crit, and so you see double zeros sometimes, and you're like, nothing.
It's always the crit.
Yeah, it's,
yeah.
Like,
it's double,
like,
numbers.
Yes.
Or
yeah.
crit failures.
Yeah, it's either a crit failure if it's above your target number, or a crit success if it's below your target number.
Okay, so if your target number is a 60, then 66 crit fail, 55 crit success.
And then
everything you get exactly. And above. But it's still also like you see 99 and you're like in your head, oh, super high number. But if you're not used to it, it's like, no, that's the worst thing you could roll. Like,
that is always a critical failure.
Yeah.
It tripped me up so much during the one shot where... I would roll low, and I'm like, yes, I succeeded. And then you guys would roll slightly higher than me and also succeed. And it's like, sorry, dude, is the low number the good one or the high?
It's low if it's below is you know, okay. But if it's high but still below, then that's the best.
You want as high a roll on the dice as possible while still succeeding.
Yes,
that is,
still being under.
That is ideal.
Yep.
And it's really annoying to get your head around. But once you do, it's such a... beautiful system, because anytime you roll the dice, you know exactly what your percentage chances are of succeeding. Because if you have, you know, an 80, you have an 80% chance of succeeding on your roll. That's great.
I also like it because it's, I feel like it's more rewarding for you as a player character, because I feel like it's easier to succeed on the things you're good at, and harder to just straight up fail on them. Because, like, you know, if I'm, like, a really good fighter, then most of the time I'm going to be hitting, right? I think that's pretty fair to say.
Yeah.
But in other systems, that's not necessarily true. I think, because, like, even getting a 1, right, on, like, a D20 system, like, that's a 5% chance. But getting a 99 is a 1% chance, right? So
The thing about that as well is that it's... A lot of systems say this flavor-wise, but this system also mechanically encourages this type of thinking, where it's like, if you succeed, you might still not get the results you want. Like you were saying, if you're a fighter, you might still succeed, but not hit the enemy, and that doesn't mean you were bad at hitting or that you missed. It just means that the opponent succeeded and they did it a little bit better than you. So it's a thing that's out of your hands. It's not that... Oh, I fumbled my gun.
Yeah.
It's no, I took a shot. It was a good shot.
Yeah.
The enemy just ducks at the right time.
Which is kind of like the same philosophy as in Blades in the Dark, where the characters don't fail because they're bad. They fail because the circumstances around what they were doing went against them.
Again, but that's why I'm saying this. A lot of systems do flavor-wise tell you that, but Blades in the Dark is still... So at the end of the time, end of the day, I failed... because my roll wasn't good. This, I feel, still shows you my roll was still good. I still know that this would have been a success.
Yeah.
They just happened to be a little bit better in this moment. And so it, like, enforces that thinking.
Reinforces that. One of my problems with the dice mechanics is how they handle contested rolls, where you still do have that, you know, you can succeed but still fail because the other person rolled better than you. So it still has those same kind of problems with where D&D has them, where it's like, oh, I rolled the dice, but it wasn't the correct number, therefore nothing happens. It doesn't feel like the game gives enough of that mechanical weight to success with consequences or, you know, a lower degree of success instead of just like, you either get it or you don't. It doesn't really matter how the dice... system is working, it still has that feel bad moment of, you know, I rolled, I succeeded. And something I felt a lot during the one shot as the GM, where it's like, my guys hit the number they wanted, and the PCs hit a slightly better number, so I don't get to do anything.
I mean, to be fair, it's, I think you're just going to encounter that with any system, because like, if we have a contested system in like, or roll in D&D, for example, you roll a 19, you rolled a fucking sick number, but I rolled a 20, you know? So, like, you're still rolling well, but it's...
Yeah.
I feel like that with less chance systems, you don't run into that as often. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, Heart, where the GM is not rolling anything. It's all dependent on you. Like, you could get a what you said, success with consequences is a thing in some other systems, where in this system it's not. It's still a chance-dependent system in that way.
I mean, Heart doesn't really have a contested role because it's only ever one person rolling. So that's kind of lets it do that.
So the audience is aware, this also works with Blaze in the Dark. That's the system we have talked about, and yet also no contested rules.
Also, future episodes, we're going to be talking about Heart and Spire and all that fun stuff.
But yeah, it's...
But I get what you're saying, and because from just backing up, looking kind of a little bit out from that, they do have systems for, degrees of success for a lot of things. So, there's very tangible ones and, things that are more a little bit more floaty.
Yeah.
For hacking, an example is if you have a task action that you want to complete. So that's, an extended action that takes a little bit of time, right?
Minutes instead of seconds.
Yeah, X amount of minutes. If you roll every 10 above, the... 10.
There's a concept called margin of success.
Yeah, margin of success and failure. And so if you hit 10 above, the how can I can't phrase this right? Yeah, somebody else take this and just cut whatever I said.
Yeah. Yeah. So the margin of success and failure thing is for every 10 you have in your roll. So let's say you roll a 20, you have two 10s.
Yeah.
You have two margins of success. If that's still a success, that's two better than getting the lowest possible success.
Yeah.
And then so on and so forth. That's why a 60 is a better success than a 20.
Yeah.
Assuming they're both successes. And the same thing with margin of failure. The further you are away from your number, let's say your target number is a 30 and you get a 60, that is three tens away from your target of 30 versus getting an 80, which is five tens away. So an 80 is a worse failure than getting a 60. Assuming they're both failures. And the game has ways to give, there are some mechanics that have tangible benefits to that.
Yeah.
Like task actions, the higher your margin of success, the more you can cut down the time it takes
it's
you.
For each 10 above zero, margin of 10, then you get 10% less
shorter
time.
Exactly. Shorter time,
it's a game that feels like it has a surprising amount of variance to it.
Yeah.
Caleb, you said earlier that it's the things that you're good at, it feels like you have a lot more control and being able to succeed with them. But it's still only it's still only chance to get those really, really big successes.
Mm-hmm.
So it opens up the opportunity to get those really strong, insane successes.
Yes.
But there's not a lot of things in the system apart from Moxie that let you, interact and get yourself to those super big successes more often.
Yeah. And I think for the one shot, I just loaded my character up with Moxie because I really want a metagame.
Yeah. Moxie is the system's
hero point, inspiration.
I was going to say it's the meta.
Yeah.
Meta currency?
Yeah, the meta currency.
It's the player's ability.
It's the edge, it's the inspiration.
Yeah.
It's the player's ability to affect anything. The uses of Moxie I like. So the main two uses for Dice Pool is you can use it to remove any negative modifier you have to a roll. So let's say, you're in a bad situation. This system does use environmental and situational modifiers.
You're surrounded and you can't see.
Yeah.
And you're locked up by the ankles.
And you're trying to hack something, but there's a lot of noise out there.
So you get those situational negative and positive modifiers to your dice roll if you're trying to do something easy. It's easier. Not to your dice roll. Again, this is to your... target number for your dice roll. You can use Moxie to ignore all negative modifiers, to be ignore everything bad about the situation, you're making it happen.
Mm-hmm.
You could also use Moxie after you roll a dice to swap the tens and the ones. So
is my favorite use of Moxie.
I like that.
Yeah. It could be you get a 71 and your target number is a 60, swap it to a 17, suddenly success.
Yeah.
Potential success.
Yeah, potential. If it's not a
success. Simple test, then yes. And that's a lot of the tests. Typically that.
Yeah. Or it could even be your target number is 80, you got a 17, maybe you swap that to a 71 so you can beat get more margins of success.
Mm-hmm.
Beat opposition. That or, thing.
Another use in that case specifically is...
making your roll a crit. Yeah.
There you go.
You can make a regular success into a critical success. You can also make a critical failure into a regular failure with the use of one moxie. So.
And also, the interesting thing about it is that if you roll a critical on your roll, you can't make your critical a better critical.
Yeah.
And you can't swap the numbers because the criticals are the same numbers.
Yeah.
So in an opposed check, if both players or both things get criticals, you can't use moxie to beat out the other person's critical. It's kind of like it becomes very like...
It's just whoever rolled the higher number.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very split second, like thematic, like there was very clearly a struggle and then there's nothing you could do about it, that the struggle happened.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like a lot of things about the system. Another big mechanical thing is like it's a heavy gear system. I feel like again, I liken it a lot to Shadowrun because I think of it as a more refined Shadowrun mechanically. And so yeah, gear plays a big part and has a big influence on what your character can do and
gear and by extension your body. Because there are different kinds of bodies that give you different stuff. You
can your have body's different... just gear.
It is. It is. It literally is. Your body or morph is just a piece of gear, which is interesting. But things like also augmentations, like
implants and stuff. Augmentations, gear. Yeah. And even some gear has gear that you can give to that gear.
Yeah.
Like there are multiple... add-ons you could add to stuff like guns that like you could add a silencer or extended mags or
even optics. The ammo within it
or different ammo because there's different kinds of ammo.
I feel like the majority of gear allow rather than giving pure mechanical benefits, but there are a lot of mechanical benefits that gear can give, but I feel like a lot of the gear that I can think of top of my head allows you to do something that otherwise you wouldn't be allowed to do.
It's very narrative.
You can survive in space or run up walls or
not get gassed in the face.
Not get gassed in the face.
Yeah, I was thinking things like LIDARs and,
T-ray emitters.
T-ray emitters.
Quantum computers. Yeah. General hives.
Yeah. You said silencer. I'm like, what a silencer is allowing you to do is fire a gun without alerting nearby people, rather than giving a mechanical benefit.
Yeah.
But then there are also stuff that just give mechanical benefits, like an enhanced eyesight mod is just gives you a bonus to your perception tests.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that I found about gear was that your morph dictates so much of what you're allowed to take in terms of the augments to your body. So there's such a big discrepancy between the synth morphs and the biomorphs and the augmentations. So the decision of taking one type of morph versus the other actually has such big implications on what your character can turn into. So it's, in my opinion, one of the most important things that you're doing even before you're looking at your morphs is what is my character concept and what gear do I want to take on them? Because that informs what your morph options
are. What do you want to be able to do with your character? Definitely. And there's the different types of gear as we're talking about. There's cyberware, bioware, nanoware, all that stuff. But then there's also just like gear outside of, you know, your morph.
Yeah, like those are all implant types.
Yeah, exactly. Implants versus just, like they call them ectos for stuff like devices. And specifically some morphs starting out just come with some implants. By default. A lot of them come with a basic...
basic biomods.
Mesh inserts, and biomods. Yeah.
Biomods and mesh inserts, which are...
Biomods if they're biological.
We're talking about more like humanoid or other biological bodies slash morphs.
Meat boys.
A lot of them come with bio What's the mesh?
Mesh inserts.
Basic mesh inserts, that's it. And so that's just your ability to access the mesh, access the pseudo-internet.
Without using your hands or anything, it's just like by brain.
By a thought, you can access and even browse the mesh.
Two things that I want to also elaborate on this gear section is, one, that there are all these kinds of options, bio mods, there's cyberware, nanoware, and then there's gear. And there are lots of those implants and gear that do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And depending on which one you pick, kind of informs the narrative of how it interacts with the world. Because if you have specs, like glasses that let you see in, you know, in ultraviolet or other spectrums, and those get broken, you no longer have access to those. But if you have eyes that let you do that, then it's much harder for them to be interacted with. But also, those eyes could be hacked, and now you've lost your eyes because those are often cyber eyes.
Yeah.
So there are different narrative considerations for the gear.
You gotta be careful, someone will hack your eyes.
Actually, even if they were biological eyes, there's the narrative implication of if they're specs, you can hand them off to other people, and other people can see you know, whatever, ultraviolet or what have you. But if they're implanted in your eyes, then, or, you know, if they're biomodded, so it's their gene-enhanced eyes to have that, then you can't have that over. That's inherently part of you.
Yeah. And so
part of this body.
It adds lots of narrative depth to the choices you make, because every choice has a different consequence or different circumstances.
There's definitely trade-offs.
Yes, there's
like,
trade-offs.
There's
yeah.
some benefits that it might provide you, and in some cases, having an external device, sometimes it might take more time to do an action, but you're protected from the potential negatives from it being inside your body.
And the second thing I wanted to say was that most characters in the setting come with what is known as a muse, which is an AI that you're essentially born with. Like, at birth, you're given this AI that basically grows with you and
as learns, a companion.
As a companion. And that is a very unique avenue of role play and storytelling that is unique to Eclipse Phase.
Yeah.
I ran an Eclipse Phase game where I wanted my players to role play the other players' muses, because technically they are separate intelligences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're their own characters. I remember that one. That was kind of fun. So you would play your own character, and then whenever any individual character, like player character, would talk to their muse, it would be somebody else, it was fun. I liked that.
Yeah. Lore-wise, they're not full intelligences. They're not a full character, but they have enough intelligence to get by. And you, at character creation, select
specialized knowledge.
Yeah,
stuff,
you select three areas of knowledge that they have. So they have those three areas of knowledge plus two things that all muses know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can pick how your muse is like, what your muse is like, but it's not a full person, not enough to have a body of its own. But it's basically your individual assistant, your individual Siri or Alexa or what have you. But
I ran
a
campaign before the one that Caleb and Ennis were in, where one of the character essentially made Crocodile Dundee, and he had an implant in his skin that made him more tough to fight, but that implant made his skin look like crocodile skin, and his name was just Dundee, so it was clearly Crocodile Dundee, and his muse was very specifically named Sheila, the whole gimmick was that it's Crocodile Dundee in Eclipse Phase, and it was very fun, and the muse kind of tied it all together because somebody else played the Sheila character, and it was very fun.
When you say play the Sheila character, I can't not think of Red versus Blue.
yeah, that's what I think of as well.
But yeah, sorry, this is kind of not related to much we're talking about, but it's related to skills. I just want to say there's a lot of skills.
Oh, yeah.
We can talk about character creation as well, because it kind of ties into that, but there's a lot of skills. Some of them you can't default. They're specific. You have to have knowledge and training in that skill. Other ones you can default. So your character sheet's going to be big with a lot of skills.
I feel like the ending character, you know, it doesn't have that many skills. I feel like it's a lot of options for skills.
Yeah.
And I feel like the skills kind of broadly break down into two categories. There's a lot of, like, the pre-designated skills. Things like perception or infosec or...
Navigation.
That are, like, this is what this skill does.
Mm-hmm.
You can choose to put points in it.
Yeah.
But then there are also a lot of skills that are open-ended. You have to fill in what they are. So, for example, academics, blank.
Yeah.
And you could choose what that blank is. And the game, like, the rulebook does have some suggestions, some common use ones, but also, you know, you can just fill that in.
Yeah.
And so you can go wild with just, like, those options. You know, fillable skills.
And the rulebook does have, first off, a designation of what certain amount of skill in a certain amount of points in a skill designates you as.
Yeah.
Like, it says, if you're at 50 points in a skill, then you are considered proficient in that skill.
Yeah.
Because you can do all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But also, the rulebook wants you to make characters that are at least somewhat balanced and full characters, and a lot of those, like, open-ended skills are in the knowledge skill category, because the game differentiates between active skills and knowledge skills.
And they also want you to, they also enforce the kind of balancing of character building by saying you have to allocate, if you're doing the normal character creation, 400 points to more active skills and 300 to knowledge-based skills.
Minimum.
For both of those, and then you can, you know, play around with the rest.
Yeah. You start with 1,000 points. You have to
in the standard
character creation. You have to spend some points on picking your morph. Like, what morph? There are morphs that cost 0 character creation points, and then you can spend your character creation points on increasing your ego traits.
Yeah,
picking up qualities, skills.
Yeah, I think for morphs,
and then for money to spend on gear.
I was just gonna say
stuff. Yeah.
For, like, morphs, it's, I think the upper end is like 50
character. But those are some really highly specialized special morphs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I was just gonna say, like, 700 is allocated to skills minimum.
Yeah.
So a lot of it's gonna be skills, and you're probably gonna even spend more on top of that.
It's the biggest avenue for spending your points, for sure.
Yeah.
And like, more, like, I feel like the gear, you can get a lot for just, like, 10 points.
Yeah.
You can get a lot of gear, 20 points.
But what if you put 300 points in?
I don't think you couldn't. You would have...
You could buy everything.
That would be... But in the setting, in the system, having everything is kind of pointless.
Yeah. My character spent so much on gear because I played a hacker in the one-shot. I maybe put 30 character creation points into, and I had, like, the most expensive top of the line stuff, and I had, like, leftover
money
and I was like,
Correct.
It's just too much. Like, you can't, like,
max out.
Yeah, like, if you're worried about not being able to afford gear, then just, like, take 3 less in a skill and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
The other avenues is you can spend it on Moxie. It's, like, 15 character creation points for every point of Moxie.
Mm-hmm.
Moxie starts at 1 and caps out at 10.
Yeah.
So the most you're spending is, like, 130 if you want to be a super Moxie-heavy character. Yeah. And
Moxie's
then,
good.
And then there's also reputation, but the game limits you at character creation to spending a maximum of 35... character creation points on reputation. So it's,
we're
mostly spending it on skills.
Yeah.
And we haven't talked about reputation because that's another very unique aspect of Eclipse Phase. Because the Eclipse Phase system has multiple different kinds of economies in the game, in the setting. And one of the big ones that kind of, like, permeates everywhere is reputation.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of like an almost post-scarcity setting.
Yeah.
And so a lot of what you have access to, the people you can talk to, etc., is dependent on your character's reputation that has a numerical value both out-of-game and in-game.
Yeah.
There are social networks dedicated to specific kinds of people, and they're represented by calling them, like, A-Rep, B rep, C rep, F rep. Yeah. And each one of those reps represents a certain kind of people,
that
can interact with. And
as an example, C rep is criminal reputation. So you're,
no, it's not.
Isn't C rep criminal?
No, C rep. So each of these reps represents a social network in the setting, and C rep is actually referred to as civil rep, and it's a civilian social network. It's like Facebook or Instagram, probably more close to Facebook. G rep, which is Guan Xi reputation network, is the criminal one.
Okay, I got the wrong letter. I just wanted to give an example.
There's criminal, there's scientists, there's autonomists.
Autonomists and scientists are actually
the same one?
That's rep.
Okay, gotcha.
Ecologists have their own
read up on rep before you take our opinions for...
Yeah, Firewall has its own rep.
IREP.
Anarchists have their rep, right?
S-rep.
Yeah, and so...
So there are these different groups you can have reputation with, and to work with that, so your rep is like your social currency.
Mm-hmm.
To work with that is there are networking skills. So your networking skills is your ability to make use of your rep. So each of these groups also has a affiliated networking skill.
Yeah.
So a character can, rather than try to buy something...
With money,
use their reputation... And the associated skill to try and make, you know, get this thing through their rep.
Yeah. And for pseudo free. It might cost you some rep, but typically not.
Yeah. So the way narratively it's described is that your rep is what you get for contributing to that faction, to that group. And so you having that rep means you've already paid something to gain that reputation.
You've done a favor for somebody.
Yeah.
You've given somebody something when they needed it.
Or you contributed to the scientific community in a big way.
Yes.
Or something like that.
Or people just like you.
Yeah, or people just like
that you. Group of people just really like you.
Yeah, because it literally, in the setting, nanofabricators and stuff like that, where like... Food is not a limiting resource in most environments, in most societies. Art and literature and...
Are highly valuable.
Are much more valuable. And so just entertainment of like being an idol, people will... Like, you can earn material things.
Yeah.
You can earn material things in exchange for your high reputation if you know how to use it right.
And that's the thing. Like, there are, depending on your specific setting, where you are in the universe of Eclipse Phase. Some value that reputation a little more, some value like actual currency, like credits a lot more, and then there's the kind of in between where it's both at the same time.
And this is all to say, and we've barely scratched the surface in terms of the depth of setting lore and information.
Mm-hmm. It's deep.
It is very deep. We haven't talked about factors. We haven't talked about what happened to Earth. We haven't talked about the governments. We haven't talked about...
Jovians.
We haven't talked about the...
Hypercorps, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we haven't talked about Hypercorps. We haven't talked about the gates that they found that lets you travel to other solar systems.
We haven't talked about the Titans.
We haven't talked about the Titans.
Yeah.
This setting is... dense, and we will not be able to get through
it. I don't think we should. I think it's a great thing that it has so much, and I love that. It really builds a full world, I think, but it
has
I
can't say the word.
Vermicitilitude?
Yeah.
I can't say it either. But it's nice, but also not nice if you're a new player coming in, especially from character creation. Like, that's already going to be a bit heavy. There are some tools to help out with that, but... Also, coming into the story, it's pretty heavy narratively as well.
Yes. I feel like more than as a player, because as a player, you can get...
Oh, as a GM.
Yeah, as a GM. I was going to say, because as a player, you can get away with not knowing a lot.
That's
fair. Like, just reading up on the factions that matter to your character.
Yeah, or when you're starting.
Just reading the brief summary and being like, yeah, this fits the concept I have for a character.
Mm-hmm. I get the vibes.
Yeah, like, I get the vibes I feel like is enough for a player.
Mm-hmm.
For the GM,
they have to do some reading.
It's a lot, as we were saying, and a lot of it has a lot. There,
And they're all connected.
Yeah, no, and so, and here's the thing. The additional books for Eclipse Phase, one of them is a morph book, which just has a longer list of morphs. Mm-hmm. And there are two or three other books that are just more lore. They're just more world setting.
More world setting, more gear, more morphs, etc. Yeah.
I think gear and morphs is like just one book. Well, either just one book or one book each. And then there's several books that are just the lore. There's just one book on inner systems.
Yeah. There's one book on Sunward, that's the inner systems. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's one book, Rimworld, which is Rimward,
so,
which is the
so
other
So what we're saying is, if you want to read, Eclipse Phase is the system for you.
There's a book just for technically just for hacking, which is Panopticon. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then you also need to read all of Altered Carbon and The Expanse to really understand where it's coming from.
Yeah.
It's homework. It's a lot of homework, I think,
especially
for the
GM
to start out.
But I think it is worth the payoff if you're willing to go through it, because I think
it creates such unique stories.
Yeah, like fleshing out a story in it, it's just going to be so satisfying, because if you have players that are invested, you're like, oh, that's connected to this thing, and it just creates a really full world.
There's inherently a lot of politics going on as well related to all the mechanics. Like, we're talking about reputation versus credits. That is like an in-world struggle that is happening with like the HyperCorp settlements going more for like a capitalist society using credits and more of like the
anarchist
societies are all for the reputation economy.
There's a whole undercurrent of like, there are certain transhumans that are appropriate and some that aren't. There is transhuman racism with AIs and uplifts being considered less human than human transhumans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think this conversation is really teeing us up for our first question in. Questions for the rest.
Oh.
So, we just talked a lot about all of the different, incredibly deep pieces of lore and, like,
setting
interesting things in the setting. Mm-hmm. So, if you had to recommend something for a new GM, which piece of, like, lore or, like, cool things in this setting, what would you tell them to focus on? Like, would it be the Titans or the Exosurgeon virus or those gates? Like, what do you think is the most interesting thing for a GM to start with?
I think it depends on the story you want to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there's a lot of variance in possible settings. Like, you could be on Mars and doing, what is the name of that famous movie with the Death Race?
Death Race?
Redline?
Mad Max. Is
Mad Max.
Yeah, you can have a very Mad Max like environment and setting on Mars versus have very like, you know, heavy corporate influence on Venus. So it kind of, there's a lot of diversity in setting. If you're new and you're overwhelmed, this is an easy one, is to play on Earth. Because Earth is where the apocalypses happened, and Earth is quarantined.
Yeah,
so
it's isolated.
It's isolated both network-wise and resource-wise. Mm-hmm. So people outside Earth don't know what's happening on Earth, and on Earth, you don't know what's happening outside, so you can kind of just ignore a lot of these political stuff and, like, set your own, like, how you imagine the world to be, and how there's also stuff written about what Earth is like, and I feel like that's like a much smaller thing to to work with. If you'd like, that's it. I think an easy one for GMs to start with is on Earth, maybe trying to escape Earth, you know, trying to escape the quarantine and enter the system at large.
I was going to say, that's a good way to extend the campaign if you want, or have another campaign afterwards, is like continuing on after that into the broader world, where you feel a little more comfortable with the system.
Yeah. If you... my other suggestion would be, there are multiple published campaigns for Eclipse Phase First Edition that are amazing primers to the setting as a whole. I think my recommendation of those would be one known as Glory, which introduces you to network slowly. It introduces you to the exosurgent virus. It introduces you to the high stakes, kind of like dread surrounding of the setting, and it's very well self-contained. Mm-hmm. So if I were like introducing new players to it, I would either go with like I'm going to use the word homebrew, but it's not. It's like personal, handcrafted Earth adventure, which is isolated, and so you can introduce elements that you want when you want it. Mm-hmm. Or I would actually go with Glory, which is a very well self-contained published adventure that you, that also helps you as a GM because it has all the information you need.
Yeah. What would you like to see a campaign centered around in terms of themes?
In terms of themes, I don't know. I think it would be a very neat idea, and I had this idea previously. This isn't like, I don't know if it'd be like new GM specific, but I think it'd be very fun to play in the Jovian system under that sort of, you know,
authoritarian
rule of law and very anti any sort of like AI. And,
mm-hmm. Anti think that would be being fun. Different.
Yeah.
Anti something starting with an S.
All right. Second question. How closely tied do you think the settings and the mechanics are? Would you run the setting with a different set of mechanics, or would you be interested in running with these mechanics in a different setting?
I think you could probably pull out bits of the mechanics and apply it to a different setting, like the skills system and the dice system. I think you could easily port that over to a different setting and a different game entirely. I think putting a new system into Eclipse Phase might be a bit harder. You could probably make it work, but I think stuff like networking and reputation, I think those are pretty kind of like lockstep with the mechanics of the game as well.
I agree with you. The system, like, again, if the reputation and the different morphs, I feel like those parts mm-hmm. are tied to the system.
Yes.
Like, those mechanics you can't play in any other system.
Yeah, I think gear specifically, right?
Not all of gear. In my head, specifically morphs.
Yeah, I think the separation of ego and morph is also very...
That's the thing that is Eclipse Phase, and so the mechanics for that, you can't use it anywhere else except the Eclipse Phase setting, and any other mechanics that you try to play in the Eclipse Phase setting will have to have some kind of homebrew for this, as well as reputation. The rest of the mechanics, like, I'm thinking Moxie, I'm thinking the dice system, I'm thinking even things like hacking and the gear that is not morphs, like the guns and the what have you, all of those could be easily taken into any other system.
Even mods, I think, like biomods and
stuff
like that.
Yeah, even mods and biomods and stuff like that, yeah, you can also take those into other systems, and I feel like it works great, the armor, all of those mechanics. But yeah, the morph and ego thing is, like, just soon into the setting.
I'm in agreement with these two. I could definitely see the grand majority of the mechanics being very easily implemented into something like even like a modern day setting, like right now this year in the world, you could make a campaign using Eclipse Phase mechanics.
It's funny we're talking about this. That's literally a campaign I have in my back pocket that I want to run at some point. Using the basic dice system and basic, you know, gear and, you know, action economy, armor,
etc.
Yeah, those systems in a modern day setting is a campaign that I have in mind to run at some point.
I was going to say, I think, like, even this, like, those, the things that we say that can be ported to another system, I think to Shadowrun would be kind of a fun idea to try to have it work there. Because I think it would work pretty well.
Yeah.
Mostly because I guess they're not too dissimilar. But
you know. Mostly because Shadowrun's mechanics suck.
Shadowrun's mechanic are crunchy, but they're too crunchy. You know, they're Lego on the floor instead of like the crisp snow when you're walking out.
My analogy is going to be Shadowrun mechanics are hot garbage, but sometimes you're cold.
That's true.
Speaking of analogies,
We'll get to that. We'll get to that.
We'll get to analogies.
I've teed up the rest when you were setting up the podcast. There's an analogy I want to talk to. Your next question.
No. Last question. What is something that we didn't get to touch about Eclipse Phase in the one shot that you wish we did?
The rep and the social networking aspect of it. Because, again, that's a very unique thing about the system. And it's just a very integral part of, like, how the world view in this world. I feel like, to be fair, a couple of things about the system that was hard. First of all, you GM'd it, and this is your first exposure to Eclipse Phase.
Second exposure.
Yeah, technically I did the Fury Road one shot.
Yeah. And so that makes those stuff a challenge. I also feel like time wise things didn't quite work out the way we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I
think having it as a one shot is challenging in and of itself.
That as well. And so I felt like our session was like 90% combat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I was trying to hit, how do I get as many mechanics as possible into this?
Yes.
And it's like, well, some things are going to happen later or are just on the cutting room floor. And, and like, the social and the rep had to be part of that. So, for the audience, don't run one-shots of Eclipse Phase. From a GM's perspective, if you are not already GMing a long campaign of Eclipse Phase, it's such a big lift to learn the system and the lore and, like, try to introduce those things. I think it's just not a great thing for one-shots in general.
Yeah, unless you already know.
Unless the group is already very familiar with Eclipse Phase.
I'd say that's probably good. And if they aren't, then, and you really want to, use pre-made characters, I think.
Yeah.
There's some sample characters in the book itself and in supplemental books.
Okay.
Also, speaking to the one-shot and not having kind of more social stuff. It was really funny because Ennis built an entirely social character with zero combat skills.
So here's the thing. We talk about all the time for these systems, especially the more complicated systems, just use a pre-made character if you're going to play for a short time or what have you. I use pre-made characters. I was ready with a pre-made character, and this is a actual pre-made character from the book. It has no combat skills. It doesn't even have a weapon. And that is viable in
a campaign.
In a campaign in Eclipse Phase, super viable. I think even viable in a one shot if it's set, you know, it depends on how the one shot is set. Because part of the reason is because that character had very strong rep, very strong networking skills, high, and a lot of the charisma based skills. And in this game, that can do a lot more. Like, you think of the typical charisma based character, you think of like a bard or a rogue doing shenanigans and face and schmoozing. But you have to realize in this game, that is as powerful as as your breaking and entering tools, because just like you can use a lockpick to enter a door, you can just as easily just use your rep and networking skills to get someone to open the door for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
I think that's an interesting point in terms of the narrative play of Eclipse Phase, but it's something that really worried me about how character creation can go, especially since combat and psi and hacking and these, like, crunchy parts of the game don't really interact with that. So it feels like it's very easy to make characters that just can't really interact with what ends up being those, like, big set pieces of a lot of campaigns, where it's like, oh, the big combat part, and it's like, my guy's gonna sit in a corner and do nothing for the next session. Which, it feels bad that it doesn't have those release valves, like something like D&D does, where it's like, oh, I have my bard and my charisma characters, and every character has this separation of, like, this is their abilities that they have for combat situations, and these are the things that they have for, social and narrative play. And it really doesn't have that distinction for every character. And so you can kind of put yourself in a box.
I think it does require a bit more creativity to involve those characters. I don't think they're dead in the water. Mm-hmm. I think, like, even the way we played the one shot with Ennis's character is having them, like, maybe be a man on the inside. Because that
and starting us off with information instead of starting us off with, like, we don't know how many people are there. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah. I earned that. We could have done more dice rolls to, mm-hmm. to get that, and that would have made it seem like I did more.
Mm-hmm.
When, with our one shot, because of time restraints, we just assumed that I had succeeded those rolls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is what we ended up doing. And I didn't even play that character. I played a second pre-made character.
And so in terms of, like, things I think we missed from the one shot, I think, like, I kind of disagree with that. There's other things that I would like to have tackled, but I don't think it's a one shot thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think dealing with the backups and changing morphs and things like that. That's hard to come up in one shot, but I think it is a very big part of the system.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I also like the thought of dealing with, like, the accumulating psychological damage, because physical damage, you can get implants and stuff that heal that over time. Psychological damage, the only way to help with that is, you know, psychology and psychosurgery, which requires another character to work with you. Otherwise, that's lasting on your character.
Right? Another, like, long-term type thing, right?
Yeah, so, and that's, like, this lasting weight where it gives characters, like, almost an inevitability, because psychosurgery, if it fails, can make that worse.
Yeah.
And even if it doesn't make it worse, it's, like, not easy to do. It's very time-consuming and what have you.
For me, one thing that I wish was in the one shot that we didn't get to do was you had set it up to be kind of like this almost corporate espionage, black site, you know, shady things done by a hyper corporation. And that specific aspect of Eclipse Phase, which is the background, like, secretive, black ops, black budget,
mm-hmm.
like, all that kind of, like, espionage aspect of Eclipse Phase, which underpins the psychological horror,
mm-hmm.
I was hoping that we would touch on it more,
mm.
like, because it was interesting that you had chosen that it was a hypercorp from the Planetary Consortium,
mm-hmm.
But their black site was in the Jovian system, which is controlled by a different governmental group.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wanted that, like, touch point of, like, why is a Planetary Consortium
mm-hmm.
entity able to operate a black site in the Jovian system?
You want a more lore tie-in?
Lore tie-in.
Explain that.
Political, mm-hmm. like, did we find out that this hypercorp is actually working with the Jovians against it? Like, there's that aspect mm-hmm. that I wanted to see. But that's because those are the kind of things I like.
That's fair.
I have one more thing, which is just a small thing. The type of psionic you chose to play, Santi, was the more, like, does all the combat things, like, has armor protection and what have. I would have liked us to have the kind of the psionic that is, like, about
manipulating,
like, the more mind hack type thing.
I was going to make that,
yeah,
but then I'm like, fuck, you're making the face character, and I didn't want to interfere with that.
We could change.
The other thing is, I did have mind hack abilities. Specifically, I had abilities where I would be able to implant thoughts into them, but it never came up.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
That's fair.
Yeah. I also used, like, detect people and implant thoughts were the things that weren't combat oriented.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions?
That's my questions.
Okay, I have one thing to mention.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in terms of hacking, it's a lot. Like, sections in the book that cover, like, the mesh, and from that is the rest of the hacking. It's not even the entire thing that you have to know for hacking, but that alone is 30 pages of some pretty dense stuff that bounces around the rulebook
a lot. And there's an entire book that gives, like, 90 pages of information about hacking.
And it's nice because there's a lot to do and it explains all the different things you can do. And so you don't feel like, let me just roll hacking. You hacked. Good job.
It's more like, I do this to do this to get this to do that.
Exactly. And I have access, but I need further access, so I need to do this. So it can be a lot, especially if you're not used to it. And also just preparing for it was a lot. And I also needed a lot of specific gear to be able to even attempt a lot of the hacking stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lot. If you want to play a hacker, it's a lot. Like
it's engaging, but it's engaging. A lot.
It's fun when you like actually understand it and understand the kind of niche devices and specific capabilities of, you know, either implants or specific types of hacks. Then it becomes fun because it's like, oh, I have the specific tool for this.
It's like a puzzle.
Exactly. And that's fun, but it can also be overwhelming in a lot. So that's just one kind of warning and caveat. I'm excited to see if or how it's different in
second edition
with a lot of stuff, to be fair.
And speaking of analogies.
So we're talking about character creation. So with like choosing points, when we're talking about mutants and masterminds, Chris brought up that it's the kind of min-maxing that's just a lot of dials.
Mm-hmm.
And I disagreed at the time because when I think dials, I do think Eclipse Phase is that character creation where you just like, you pick your morph, you pick your gear, whatever, that uses like 100 character creation points, maybe 150, and then you're left with the rest just for your skills.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about like, you know, you can increase this one by one, to increase this one by, decrease this one by a little bit, yeah, to increase that one. Oh, this one, I want to bump it up a couple more points. In the rulebook, it's like, oh, go in, you know, sets of 10 or sets of 5.
Yeah.
But really, the most min-maxy thing you can do is have your skills on double numbers.
That's what I did. That's what I ended up doing. I ended up doing that a lot.
Yeah, because like the difference between a 65 and a 66 is that the 66 is a crit.
Yeah.
And it's a crit success if your skill level is a 66. It's a crit fail if your skill level is a 65.
But also during character creation, you have to count for, oh, do my attributes like add to that to make it exactly that?
Yeah, do I also have a gear bonus or morph bonus?
Yeah. So there is definitely this turning of dials, get everything exactly right. I min-maxed it a big amount, and then I ended up having like a decent bit of like creation points left. And I was like, I could just like keep going with it, but I ended up just having like 30 extra left over. And I was like, this feels right. Like I could just keep min-maxing.
I don't know. My problem with the min-maxing in Eclipse Phase is that it feels like all of the min-maxing only is to do with the one mechanic, which is, you know, the D100 rolls and modifiers to improve or get rid of that. As opposed to something like Lancer, where your min-maxing is around like keywords and like interacting different mechanics and effects and like other ways of manipulating the environment and other characters.
So you want more of a creative maxy approach rather than just like a...
How do I maximize this spreadsheet?
Yeah.
That's all it is.
That's fair.
Yeah. I will say, that's funny because the two of you did not use the spreadsheet.
No, I didn't.
Did you?
Yes.
Okay.
I was the only one that didn't, I guess.
Yeah. I knew it was someone. I thought it was both of you. It's just you. But yeah, there's a spreadsheet that calculates everything for you, and then you can just see what your total is, and you literally are min-maxing a spreadsheet. You're optimizing a spreadsheet.
Yeah, see, that would have been easier because I was min-maxing.
Yeah.
It took me a decent while to create my character. Again, one-shots, stick away.
Use a pre-made character. I did. And it wasn't optimized. It wouldn't have taken a lot of time to optimize. Mm-hmm. I could have easily just, you know, like bump this down a little bit, bump this up a bit kind of thing to like tweak it.
It's obvious to min-max, I think.
Even the character that didn't have a weapon, they had enough cred to buy a weapon, like at character creation. I could have just added, you know, a couple weapons and they would have been usable as well.
And talking about character creation, just very quickly,
mm-hmm.
a supplemental book for Eclipse Phase introduces what is known as the life path system.
Yes.
And that kind of like streamlines character creation in a way that lets players create characters fairly quickly,
mm-hmm.
without having to worry about min-maxing or like specific traits or whether they work. Because the life path system is basically you start from the beginning of the character and you basically choose events and things that happen to them, and those specific events and career choices, etc., give them certain additional stats.
They do that in, like, video games sometimes as well to, yes. like, help you kind of right. just end up with the stats instead of having to worry about every single little thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think
that's transhumanism, by the way.
Yes, yeah. that's the book.
Yeah. We could talk about this more perhaps in the next episode yeah. because yes. The second edition has a simplified life path system as the
core character
yeah. creation yeah. model.
But I did want to mention it that the first edition does add it with yeah. a supplemental book.
Yeah, and yeah. so I think it's worth looking into if you are going to play Eclipse Suite's first edition. Mm-hmm. Also, one more thing that I want to mention before we're finishing is the initiative system, because I think it is very similar yeah. to Shadowrun 5th edition,
yeah.
and it can bog things up a little bit. Not as bad as 5th edition Shadowrun, but very similar. And I see yeah. you have opinions about this.
I was going to say, it's the same problem as the Shadowrun, where mm-hmm. it's like you reroll at the top of every turn, and the turn has... Some people will act only once, some people will act multiple times.
Yeah.
Unlike Shadowrun, I feel like it's much easier to homebrew, mm-hmm. because the number you roll doesn't affect anything other than your order in Eclipse Phase, so you can just keep that same number the whole way through. In Shadowrun, the number you roll affects how many turns you get,
yeah.
but in this, that's a separate stat. That's your speed stat, that's how many turns you get,
mm-hmm.
which means that this is a super easy homebrew if you'd like. Just roll it the first time at the start of combat. That determines the order and keep that order.
That's what we ended up doing for the yeah. one shot.
That's what yeah. we ended up doing for the one shot instead of having to keep re-rolling.
I think it's stupid to re-roll it.
It's the biggest like downside in combat in Shadowrun and in Eclipse Phase as well. And in Eclipse Phase, super easy to homebrew. So
super easy to get rid of.
Yeah.
Super easy to get rid of.
Just yeah. And that's the thing. Like... Another, this is kind of, you make me think of more things, but there's optional rules, like, even within the book. There's, yeah. like, things for, like, exalted stunting.
Yes.
Like, you can do that to add modifiers to your rolls, right? Mm-hmm. Or
yeah.
the
yeah,
target
like narrative
number.
Description. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you describe something narratively in
you
a really
like
cool
a plus
way.
10 or a plus 30.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. And so there's optional rules. Again, yeah. there's always the golden rule. They even say it in the book, obviously. Any good book does. But just get rid of anything that's
not fun.
Not fun.
Yep. Yeah.
So I think that's about it.
Yeah. I don't know. I really like the system. I think
yeah.
it's genuinely one of my favorites. Like, just... Oh, we did the one shot and I read the book for this
yeah.
and now I just want to play. I want to quit my other campaigns to play Eclipse Phase. I just really
yeah.
like it.
There's
yeah.
a common cycle for me where I'll be like, oh, this setting. And
but there's always Eclipse Phase.
The most consistent one is like, kind of want to play Eclipse Phase.
it's very fun. Yeah, just from reading the book and remembering our previous campaign, I was like, damn. I'd have a lot of fun if we
yeah.
were doing this.
And maybe you'd actually get to play the violin this time.
Yeah. Yeah.
This
yeah.
is a tangent, and we might cut this. But I feel like there's also like a part of like playing a tabletop RPG that you do it for escapism. And I feel like just the fact that you can change your body or, you know, it's like
yeah.
there's like this freedom of choice in the game that is like the gender you were born with, your brain is just going to be digitized and you could be like whatever the fuck you want. You want to be an octopus?
Yeah.
Be an octopus. You want to be like some bird in the sky. You want to be some monkey.
Yeah.
Some
do you
want
to retire
dolphin?
To swim in the oceans of the sun? Because that's what space dolphins do in
yeah.
this setting.
Yeah, like you can go super weird and hedonistic. It's like you want each of your tentacles. You want to be an octopus with each of your tentacles being a different genital? Yes.
You want to be an octopus and having multiple copies of yourself inside your head that each controls a different appendage?
Yeah,
it has this like freedom of choice thing that like is much stronger than any other game.
I think you can tell how much there is to the system and how much we enjoy the system by how long this episode is. I think it's going to be a bit of a longer one.
I think that the rest of you could talk about Eclipse Phase for another hour,
yeah.
but I'm out of content.
I was going to say, how do you feel about Eclipse Phase? Because we're all gushing about it.
Yeah.
And
Chris,
like, we're the ones that like kind of pushed for it so early on because we're like, we love this system.
Yeah.
We got to play it.
I think Eclipse Phase, the lore and the world and the setting is probably one of my favorites. just in terms of how out there and how many interesting ideas there are to play with. Mm-hmm. Like, it's such a cool sandbox. I think the mechanics are ass. Specifically, the contested roles need so much work, and I would not ever run them as is. And I feel like that's such a core part of the system that I have such a, like, sincere gripe with that I would need someone to convince me to play Eclipse Phase as is. But I think it has such a, it has so much potential as a system, and I think with a few, like, honestly pretty minor tweaks, it would be so fun to play.
Maybe you'll like second edition.
Maybe I'll like second edition. I think I might like second edition more than first edition,
you
and it's going to hurt all
you.
You
developed some very real trauma from those contested rolls.
Yeah.
Oh, I did.
Because I remember when you're rolling, and you're like, but I got it.
But I
got it better.
No. I succeeded better.
I liked a part of it is Chris is the newest to the system, and he was the one GMing.
Yeah.
All the players, including the fourth person we had, were all more familiar with the system. And I felt like sometimes as a GM, you tell your players no, and you know that you can see them be deflated.
Yeah.
I feel like we were doing that to Chris.
Yeah, I think I started the session with, it's kind of refreshing to be GMing a system where all of the players are more familiar with the system.
Yeah.
And then slowly as the night went on, it was like, I'm just getting bullied.
Hey, it's not our fault you forgot your Reaper had the speed of 2.
Yeah,
that was a big one.
That's
alright.
But yeah, shout out to Will. You know, thanks for joining us for that one. That was really fun.
Rest in peace, boy.
What? He's alive.
He's alive, we promise.
Yeah. You take that back right now.
With that said.
Yeah, I think it's about time to wrap up. So, from all of us here, thanks for listen to us talk about another really cool system. Hopefully you guys will enjoy it as well. Pick up a copy of Eclipse Phase and try it out for yourself. But yeah, thanks for listening. As always, my name is Caleb, and joining me have been
Ennis,
Chris,
Santiago.
And did you know that the only countries that use the Imperial system currently are the US, Myanmar and Liberia. So that's
cool.
Kind of a weird club to be a part of, I guess.
They're the first ones to go to the apocalypse.